I'm Noam Chomsky. You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz. First, people have to understand, yes, we're being oppressed. The structures of domination that exist have no legitimacy. And to get to understand that is extremely hard. Even quite apart from the costs of resisting it, which are real, certainly at the early stages, but even just getting it internally. Well, you know, as that comes along, you start getting institutions that support it, like, for example, support groups. Finally, even the law and the police departments, yeah, now they support it.
You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz. My name is John Malkin, and the name of this program is The Great Leap Forward. This program is devoted to exploring social change and spiritual growth, compassion, and anarchy. You can hear this program every Wednesday night right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz on the internet at www.freakradio.org. My special guest this evening is Noam Chomsky. Noam Chomsky is a longtime political activist, writer, and institute professor of linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He's the author of numerous books and articles on U.S. foreign policy, international affairs, and the media. His most recent books include Deterring Democracy, Year 501, The Conquest Continues, Rethinking Camelot, and Letters from Lexington, Reflections on Propaganda. His latest book is Hegemony or Survival, America's Quest for Global Dominance. I had the great honor to meet in person with Noam Chomsky last Friday, November 19th, 2004. I was grateful to have the opportunity to speak with him in person at MIT, where he teaches linguistics, and I'm grateful I was able to ask him some questions about the recent elections here in the United States and the propaganda surrounding the presidential campaigns, as well as questions about Israel and Palestine and anarchism as a strategy for social change. Here now is Noam Chomsky on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Noam Chomsky, I feel very happy to be sitting here with you. It feels great to meet you in person.
Glad to be with you.
Many people in this country became politically active, some of them for the first time, during the recent presidential campaign. They were working to end George Bush's presidency. A lot of them are now expressing despair and disappointment about the election results. I wonder what your feelings and thoughts are about the recent election and about the propaganda during the campaigns and now after the elections.
Well, the despair is common, but it's a misunderstanding. For one thing, the elections tell us virtually nothing about the country. In fact, from the point of view of a democratic society, there weren't any elections. If you just take a look at the basic facts, I mean, Bush got about 31% of the electorate. Kerry got about 29%. The voting patterns were almost the same as in 2000, you know, same red states, same blue states. There was a slight shift. Apparently what happened is that the wealthier part of the population which tend to vote more, and they vote for their class interests. They came out somewhat more than they did last time. That's what probably tipped it. If the voting patterns had shifted slightly and Kerry was in the White House, it would also tell us nothing about the country. And the reason for that is you find out as soon as you look at how people were voting and what their attitudes are. Now, that happens to be very well studied in the United States, very well studied. And right before the elections, there were extensive studies released about it. Turns out about 10% of the voters were voting for what they called agenda, policies, programs, and ideas. The rest were voting for imagery. Elections are run by the same people who sell toothpaste and cars. Now, they don't believe in markets. If you believed in markets, advertising would be, say, GM would say, here are the models I'm putting out next year, here are their characteristics. Now, that's if you believe in the nonsense you're taught in school about consumer choice and, you know, rational choice by informed consumers and so on. Yeah, that's what you would do. But they can't do that because what their model is the same as the next guy's model. So what they do is put up, an actress or a football player, or, you know, a car going up a sheer cliff or something or other, and they try to create an image that'll deceive you into buying their product. In fact, the whole system is based on deception of consumers. It's not a secret. Just turn on the television set, and half of what's there is forms of deception of consumers, and huge amounts of money and effort go into it. Well, these are the same people who run elections. So they construct imagery. Bush is trained to project a certain image, a guy just like you, a guy you'd like to meet in a bar. He's going to protect, he has your interests at heart. He'll protect you from danger, that sort of thing. Kerry's trained to project a different image. I care about the economy. I care about health. You know, I'm a war hero and so on and so forth. So people who care about those things, and that's how people vote. If they buy the image, they'll say, okay, if I'm going to vote, I'll vote for that image. If you compare the image to the reality, which has been done, this have no relation to each other. People tend to believe that the candidate they're voting for shares their beliefs. It's almost always completely false. I mean, I don't know what the candidate believes, but at least the parties. And that's been studied too. So Bush voters believed that Bush supported what they wanted, and they're totally wrong. The Republican Party program was almost exactly the opposite. Same with Kerry voters. So people vote for images the way you buy toothpaste. They do not pay attention to issues. And in fact, when you ask them why, they say, because we don't understand the candidate's stand on the issues, which is correct. The election's designed so that you won't understand. In fact, to try to figure out, say, what their health programs were, it takes a research project. And you're not supposed to know. I mean, the advertising industry wants to focus on what they call qualities, not issues. Well, when you take a look at people's stands on issues, you understand that. Again, right before the election, two of the major public opinion studies organizations in the country, very reputable one, best ones in the world, came out with major studies of popular attitudes. And they blow your mind. You know, they're so far to the left of either political party that the press can't even report it. So huge majorities think that funding ought to go for health, education, Social Security, not military, on what's called preemptive war. You know, can you use force? Overwhelming majority opposed. An overwhelming majority says, no, you can only use force if you're under attack or under imminent threat of attack, which is the traditional interpretation of international law, and both parties reject it, and it's not discussed in the public arena. A majority are in favor of signing the Kyoto Protocol, of subjecting the U.S. to the International Criminal Court, to the World Court, which the U.S. rejects. Large majority thinks the U.N. ought to take the lead, not the United States, on international crises. In fact, a majority even supports giving up the veto at the Security Council. So the U.S. will not be able to veto. It will have to go along with opinions of the majority. Mm-hmm. I can go on. Mm-hmm. But these things are so far off the spectrum that you can understand why the advertising industry has to keep issues out of the election and not and focus on the imagery they concoct of candidates. And it's kind of natural in a society where the whole system is based on deceit. The market, so-called, is not a market. It's based on deceiving consumers. So consumer choices are structured. The political system is based on deceiving voters. So they'll pick this or that image. And if you look at where the source of power is, it's exactly what you'd predict if you were looking at the society from the outside. I mean, the way to overcome that is to create a democratic culture in which there are political parties. The United States doesn't have them. You have political parties in which people participate, where they make the decisions. They don't come together once every 4 years to push a lever. That's not politics. It's the opposite of politics. They're working all the time at local levels, regional issues, international solidarity, and so on. I mean, if you have mass popular organizations that are functioning all the time at every level, then at least you have the basis for a democracy. And it's existed here in the past. It's what unions were at one time. And it exists right now in other countries. So take, say, the second biggest country in the hemisphere, Brazil. I mean, they actually have a democratic system. We don't. So in Brazil, voters didn't have to choose between two rich kids who went to the same elite university and joined the same secret society and are funded by the same corporations. They could vote for their own person, a very impressive figure didn't have any higher education, a peasant, a steel worker, and so on. I mean, that's inconceivable in the United States. We don't have elections. We don't have a functioning political system. And the reason they could do it is because they do have it. I mean, the landless workers movement is probably the most important popular organization in the world. And it's working all the time. It doesn't come out every 4 years to push a lever. The Workers' Party, which has all kind of flaws, serious ones, but nevertheless, it's a mass popular organization working at every level. There are professional associations that are acting. There's all there are areas where the budget is popularly decided in Puerto Alegre, for example. And that's the core of a democratic society. It's the basis of a democratic culture. If you don't have at least that, you can have formal elections, but not meaningful ones. And that is indeed the concept of democracy that's held here in elite opinion. And it goes right back to the Constitutional Convention, where Madison laid it out. The power has to be in the hands of the wealth of the nation, he said, people who understand the needs of property owners and recognize that the priority of government is to protect the minority, the opulent, against the majority. The majority has to be fragmented in some fashion. And there have been 200 years of struggle about this, because people don't accept it. So they've gained a lot of rights. And in fact, we have a legacy of freedom, which is in many ways unique. But it wasn't granted from above. It was won from below. And the battle keeps going. I mean, the wealthy and privileged are always involved in an unremitting, bitter class war. They never stop for a minute. If one technique doesn't work, you shift to another one. And if the general population is willing to become pessimistic, which is what they want, of course, and to say, okay, we give up, then they'll do exactly what's in their interest.
It seems like in the rest of the world, the deception of the United States and the way that propaganda manipulates public opinion is clear, and that this deception is being unveiled or has for a long time become unveiled. I'm wondering, particularly with the revelations about there never having been weapons of mass destruction in Iraq prior to the recent U.S. attack there, and the placing of Halliburton in to clean up the war, and the Abu Ghraib torture scandal, and even this week, the news reports about there having been an execution of an Iraqi by a U.S. soldier. Do you think that this group of information that has been fairly recent is waking up people in the United States to the deception?
See, I don't want to be impolite and critical, but what you've just reported is sophisticated propaganda. So let's say take the Marine who killed somebody in a mosque. I mean, as compared with what's going on in Fallujah, is that an atrocity? I mean, it isn't even a minor footnote. What's an atrocity is what you read on the front page of the New York Times, where you have a picture, front page picture, of patients and doctors lying on the floor manacled, and the soldiers standing guard over them. And the front page story tells you proudly, American soldiers broke into Fallujah General Hospital, forced patients out of their beds to lie on the floor with handcuffs. That's a war crime. I mean, the Geneva Conventions state explicitly, that's the foundation of modern humanitarian law, it's the supreme law of the land in this country, it says that hospitals must be protected at all times by all forces in the country. So what the New York Times is telling us, loud and clear, is that our president is a war criminal. And in fact, what they're also telling you, if you read U.S. law, is he's subject to the death penalty under U.S. law, because the War Crimes Act of 1996, passed by a Republican Congress, states that grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions are war crimes punishable by death. Okay, so what the Times is telling us, that the entire White House is subject to the death penalty for this act alone. Then they go on to describe the war crime. New York Times, let's keep to the best newspaper. They say, well, this was an achievement because the Fallujah General Hospital was a propaganda center for the insurgents. Why? Because it was producing inflated reports of casualties. Well, first of all, how do they know they were inflated? Because our leader told us so. And we have to be like North Korea. If our leader says something, it's automatically true for the front page of the greatest newspaper in the world. But putting that aside, suppose they were reporting casualty figures. Why is that propaganda for the insurgents? I mean, it means they're breaking our propaganda rules, which is that you see what's happening to the victims. I mean, we don't embed reporters with Iraqis. No, we embed them with U.S. forces, just like the Russians did in Afghanistan. The model. So then they'll report from our side, you know. So in fact, you know, the reason they're going after this Marine is because he's vulnerable. See, that Marine, whoever he is, he's not somebody like us, you know, kind of nice, educated people wearing ties, sitting in air-conditioned offices. He's probably some kid from you know, disadvantaged background. They're shooting at him from all over the place. He doesn't know what the hell he's doing. So he, you know, he lost it. Okay. So we can criticize him because he's somebody else, you know. How about criticizing the guys who sent him there? I mean, they're the criminals. Like in the Nuremberg Tribunal, they didn't go after the soldiers. They went after the German foreign minister. He was hanged, okay, not the soldiers. Same with Milai. I mean, half-educated, you know, half-crazed GIs in the field, you know, who didn't know who's going to shoot at him next. Yeah, okay, they carried out a massacre. Milai was a tiny footnote to a major mass murder operation, Operation Wheeler-Wallowa, which was organized by nice people like us, you know, educated Harvard graduates, air-conditioned offices, so therefore they're immune. The real criminals are immune, but you can go after some minor person who you can say, well, you know, bad apple, not like us good guys. This is all propaganda. In fact, the whole invasion of Fallujah was very much like Srebrenica, you know, which we consider the ultimate crime. In Srebrenica, the Serb forces, who didn't just attack out of nowhere. I mean, Srebrenica was a protected area that was being used to attack Serb villages, and they knew they were going to react. You know, there's a big Dutch government report on this. Finally, they reacted. They got all the men and women, all the women and children and old people were driven out. The men were forced to stay, and then they killed them. What did we do in Fallujah? Women and children were driven out, mostly by bombing. Men were not allowed out. They were forced back in so they could be killed. Well, Schreper Nietzsche has described as genocide. Okay, what about Fallujah? Well, actually, that's described as genocide too, though it's not reported here. So I was just reading an Italian newspaper, and they had a report about a statement by Nobel Peace Prize winners, L'Equalessa, Esquivel, Rigoberta Menchú, Bishop Bello of East Timor, you know, a lot of others, and they said the invasion of Fallujah is genocide. Okay, so even the hospital doesn't count. Furthermore, let's go back to the Nuremberg Tribunal. It states explicitly that the supreme international crime, which encompasses all the evil that follows, is aggression. So once the U.S. invaded Iraq, that is the supreme international crime. It encompasses all the evil that follows, including the war crimes being carried out in Fallujah and being described happily on the front pages. They're all encompassed in it. Abu Ghraib is encompassed in it. Everything is encompassed in the supreme international crime, and it was for participating in the supreme international crime that the Nazis were hanged, like the foreign minister, for example. On the Tokyo Tribunal, was even more severe. Well, you know, do we believe in it or don't we? If we believe in it, fine, let's say so. But then not talk about these minor crimes. They're bad, but they're encompassed in the overall evil. And the reason why you can't talk about that is because then it comes right back to us, nice folks, you know, nice, wealthy, privileged folks. We're the ones responsible. The representatives and the command, and in fact both political parties, because they both agree with it. You know, so yeah, then we're coming back to the way we treated defeated countries. If we had the honesty to look at ourselves with the same standards we applied to defeated countries, a lot of things would follow. And the population, incidentally, does not agree with this. These figures that I just showed you do, actually, on the weapons of mass destruction, it's quite interesting. So in the polls last October, studies, turns out 75% of the population says we should not have invaded Iraq if it did not have weapons of mass destruction. On the other hand, 50% say we should have invaded Iraq. It's not a contradiction. 50% still believe they either had weapons of mass destruction or ties to 9/11 or something like that. Okay, that's the effectiveness of government media propaganda. I mean, if you can brainwash people sufficiently, yeah, they'll believe things which actually fit their own judgments and moral values, but you know, it's kind of like off the wall. I mean, if you go back to Germany in the 1930s, I mean, the population didn't think they were committing atrocities. They thought they were defending themselves. And in fact, in some cases, they had say take Japan. You know, let's take Arab principles. I mean, our principles are that we have a right, this is both political parties, whole spectrum, we have a right to attack a country that might be a threat to us. Okay? Actually, the population doesn't agree, as I said, but the common view is what's called preemptive war, anticipatory self-defense. We have a right to attack someone if they're posing a threat to us, even if it's not imminent. All right. Does everybody go out in the streets December 7th every year to praise the Imperial Japanese fascists for bombing Pearl Harbor and Hawaii? Why not? I mean, they had a much stronger case than we had. I mean, they could read the American press, which was talking quite openly about how B-17s, which were then just coming off the Boeing assembly lines, could bomb Japan, incinerate its wooden cities, and exterminate the Japanese from Hawaii and the Philippines. So did Japan, under those conditions, have a right to attack military bases in Hawaii and the Philippines? Well, you know, by our standards, we should be praising it. So we should be praising Pearl Harbor as a really marvelous achievement, by a noble act by our standards. Well, you know, until we can get to the point of looking at ourselves that way, we have not had an education. I mean, in a free country, these are the kind of things you teach in elementary school. Then you get to hard stuff later. And until everyone understands that, like in their bones, that we haven't become a free country.
How do you recommend that people do look at themselves? People seem pretty caught up in the propaganda and in the belief structures that are imposed on them through education and television.
It's not quantum physics. I mean, any child can do it. You know, it's really easy. And in fact, when you get popular movements started, it happens very quickly. So take the original sin of U.S. history. What is it? It's extermination of the native population. So there were maybe, I don't know, who knows, we don't count our victims, maybe 8-10 million people here. I mean, they're not here. I don't see them. You don't see them. California was one of the worst places. You know, they really exterminated. Until the 1960s, this simply was not an issue. I mean, like when I was a kid, and we considered ourselves sort of radical, you know, we were playing cowboys and Indians. We were the cowboys killing the Indians. If you read diplomatic history or anthropology in the 1960s, they just denied it. So, a couple of hunter-gatherers scattered around. The movements of the 1960s, one of their achievements was to bring this into popular consciousness. It's only since the 1970s, as an effect of this, that the issue is finally being faced. It's not that anyone's doing anything about it, but at least there is now a recognition that some hideous crime took place. And a lot of people do know about it, in fact. Well, you know, it was never hidden very far. It was just suppressed. Like in California, you know, where it was a monstrous story, and one of the latest parts of it, sort of mid-19th century, and nobody was aware of it. I mean, to this day, the first executive war in American history, transferred the right to wage war to the executive, not to Congress, in violation of the Constitution. That's been just about every war since. The first one was 1818, first Seminole War, when Andrew Jackson invaded Florida. He was attacking what were called the runaway Negroes and lawless Indians, who were a threat to us. You know, because maybe they'd do something to us, so therefore we had to destroy them. Well, the Seminoles were driven into the swamps, driven to the west, where they later suffered the same fate, pretty well wiped out. They survive, namely as the mascot of Florida State University. I mean, you know, that's as if Munich University had as its mascot the Kikes, you know, or something like that. Does anybody notice it? Well, you know, by now you can get to notice it. Our lethal weapons are named after victims of genocide. Black Hawk, Tomahawk missiles, you know, just freely. Victims of genocide are our most lethal weapons. I mean, if Germany was doing this, you know, we'd berserk. These things did come to popular consciousness. The same is true of a lot of other issues. I mean, right now, for example, there is protection for abused women. Okay, so like the police have, even in professional towns like where I live, there's you can get a 911 call for domestic abuse, and there are trained police who come, there are women supports groups, there's laws about it, and so on. It wasn't true in the 1960s. I mean, that's just life. You know, husband wants to beat you up, yeah, this is the way you're supposed to be, you know. Well, people weren't, and in fact, women weren't aware of it. I mean, if you go back to, say, my grandmother, she would not have considered herself oppressed because that's just what life was. And when you get to my mother, she did resent it, but she didn't try to change it. When you get to my daughter, I mean, like, forget it. It's not going to happen for a second. Okay, that's a change in popular consciousness, and it came through popular activism, and the same is true of everything else. I don't think you can think of a case where rights have been granted from above. I mean, that's the way it's written in history. You know, this great man gave us rights. If you actually look at what happened, they were won from below. And the great man was dragged kicking and screaming into signing something. And it does happen. It happens right in our recent lifetimes. It's happened significantly.
I want to hear the relationship that corporations have in all of this. You've said that corporations grew out of the same soil as other forms of the 20th century totalitarianism, out of the same thinking that led to fascism and Bolshevism. Tell me about the relationship between corporations, media, and the government.
Well, corporations actually do have the same intellectual origins as fascism and Bolshevism. They come sort of out of, you know, kind of neo-Hegelian ideas that were developing in the late 19th century about organic entities which have rights over and above individuals. You know, classical liberalism was, in theory at least, that people of flesh and blood had rights, not abstract entities. But the corporate systems that were being developed, you know, toward the end of the century had a different conception. You know, the organic entities have rights. And this took various forms. One of them is fascism. One's Bolshevism, which were varied. And another is corporatism. How did government come in? Well, actually not much. It's mostly the courts. I mean, the courts over the years gradually, a corporation back, say, in the early 19th century, say in where we are, Massachusetts, it would be, you know, local people getting together in a town meeting and deciding to build a bridge across a nearby river. They could incorporate to carry that out. In fact, municipalities were corporations. And once you carried it out, dissolved the corporation. And it gradually was changing through the 19th century, but by the early 20th century, the court stepped in radically, and this radical judicial activism, and they granted corporations, these legal fictions, the rights of persons. Okay, that meant they get freedom of speech, they get freedom of search and seizure, which means they're unaccountable, can't know what they're doing. They can advertise freely, they can, and of course they're immortal persons, and huge. Later court decisions by, say, around the First World War made the rational decision that these have to be completely pathological persons. They have to be committed by law to actions that we would regard as pathological if ordinary people did them. They have to be dedicated solely to a maximization of profit and market share. If they do anything decent, that's illegal. Okay, it's like saying every person has to be a torturer, you know, and if you don't, it's illegal, we put you in jail. That's about what it amounted to, and it made sense. You know, it said, look, they're owned by their shareholders, and the shareholders have a right to profit. If the manager, you know, does something decent, it cuts profit back. Actually, there was an exception granted. You can do something decent if it's purely hypocritical. So, for example, a drug company can hand out drugs in the slums as long as there's a television camera following it, because that improves market share. So, therefore, that's legitimate. In fact, one decision in the 60s, court decision, actually urged corporations to carry out humane acts because it said otherwise an aroused citizenry will discover the privileges that you have and will take them away from you. So therefore, you should go out of your way to look decent. I mean, that's still within the law. The new trade agreements, like, say, NAFTA and the World Trade Organization, I mean, they grant corporations rights incomparably beyond persons. So, like, if General Motors goes to Mexico and sets up a plant, they have to receive what's called national treatment. They have to be treated like a Mexican person, a corporation. I mean, if a Mexican of flesh and blood comes to New York and asks for national treatment, if he's lucky, he'll be sent back to Mexico. If he's unlucky, he'll end up in Guantanamo or somewhere. But this goes on across the board. So these a corporation, or for that matter, any business, is simply a form of tyranny. It's a private tyranny. It's as close to totalitarian as anything humans have devised. Orders come from above. They're handed down below. You know, your junior manager takes them and gives them down below. At the bottom, you can rent yourself to it. It's called getting a job. And you can buy their stuff. But there they want to make sure that you don't have a market. that you don't have informed consumer choice, like they teach you in economics departments. That's not allowed to exist. You have to have massive deceit, so you can't have informed consumer choice. That's why they spend hundreds of billions of dollars a year in advertising. That's the system. Does it have any legitimacy? No, zero. Can you remove it? Sure, you're going to remove it. In fact, there was a case in the California courts, which went surprisingly far before it was struck down, where there was an effort to compel the Attorney General to follow the law. The law requires that the Attorney General take away the charter from corporations involved in criminal acts. The corporation in that case was Unocal. They were charged with criminal acts in California, like, you know, pollution and stuff like that, and also using slave labor in Burma. Those are criminal acts under U.S. law. So the Attorney General was requested to apply the law. Well, you know, to everyone's surprise, it actually went through a couple of levels of the courts before they found some deceitful way to strike it down. But with enough popular pressure, that's perfectly possible. And there's no reason why such institutions should exist and why they shouldn't be under popular democratic control at every level. But that's all within, certainly within range. I mean, it's not going to happen by itself.
I would like to hear more about the direction that our society could take. And sometimes you've described it as a democratic society. Sometimes you've used the word anarchism. And I want to ask you something specific about anarchism. In a 1976 interview on the BBC, focusing on your ideas regarding anarchism, you are asked how much the success of an anarchist society depends on a fundamental change in the nature of people's motivation, altruism, and sophistication. And you answered that it not only depends on it, but in fact the whole purpose of libertarian socialism is that it will contribute to it. On the one hand, it requires that spiritual transformation, and on the other hand, its purpose is to create institutions that will contribute to that transformation. Please tell me more about the connection between spiritual transformation and institutional transformation, and this quality of simultaneous personal and social change, how they feed each other.
It's really pretty simple, and it goes right back to the Enlightenment and the origins of classical liberalism. So if you read, say, Kant, at the time of the French Revolution, there was a lot of screaming about the tyranny of the rebels, and he wrote that, they shouldn't do bad things, but we have to understand that the only way to, you can't be given freedom. You have to win freedom, and then you have to internalize what it means to be free. So you have to create institutions in which you can be free. You'll probably misuse them, but through having them, you'll gain the discovery of your own conception of freedom. And that's the way everything works. I mean, take, say, women's rights. That was a combination of change of spiritual transformation and institutional change. And you can't really say which came first. I mean, the women's movement started with consciousness-raising sessions. You know, women would get together and talk to each other and get to understand that you do not, that we first understand you are being oppressed. Most people don't realize they're being oppressed. You say, okay, that's the way the world is. Like, even slaves didn't think they were oppressed. That's just the way it was. You know, like I said, my grandmother didn't feel oppressed. It's just the way it is. You know, it's like the weather. First, people have to understand, yes, we're being oppressed. The structures of domination that exist have no legitimacy. And to get to understand that is extremely hard. I mean, even quite apart from the costs of resisting it, which are real, certainly at the early stages, but even just getting it internally. Well, you know, as that comes along, you start getting institutions that support it. Like, for example, support groups. Finally, even the law and the police departments. Yeah, now they support it. Okay, but, and, or, you know, granting legal rights, you know, say, family leave, which now in many places you have for both parents. I mean, in other countries, way more, but here, a little too. Well, so there's a combination of internal liberation, spiritual transformation, if you like, and building of institutions which support it and transfer it on and enable you to realize it. Mm-hmm. And that's true of every aspect of life. Mm-hmm. And it's true of democratic societies. It's true of the business world. I mean, in fact, it's taken a huge amount of effort to drive these notions out of people's heads. So if you go back to the early stages of the Industrial Revolution, which happened to be right around here, you know, Lowell and Lawrence and stuff, the textile mills, the workers there were running their own newspapers. I mean, that was the period of the freest press in the history of the United States. There were worker-run newspapers. There were community newspapers. They were bigger than the scale of the commercial press, and people were participating in them. So the working people in the plants at, say, Lowell, who were mostly young women from the farms or, you know, Irish artisans from the slums, were expressing themselves. I mean, they never heard of Marx. They never heard of anarchism. It's just what they were expressing themselves. And they simply took it for granted that those who work in the mills should own them and decide how they work, that wage slavery is hardly different from chattel slavery. Taking a job is the same as being having a master command you. Actually, that's classical liberalism, if anybody looks back. You know, they condemned the industrial system because it was turning them into serfs and taking away their culture and their freedom and their independence and turning them into robots and so on instead of free people. Well, you know, all of that is just people's natural instincts. And it's taken a century and a half of unremitting propaganda to try to drive these thoughts out of people's heads. I think they're just below the surface. Like, I don't think they ever get driven very far out of people's heads. And as soon as the issues open up, you know, you can see, I mean, I've talked about it in every possible place, and it becomes obvious right away. Mm-hmm. But it just has to be kept down. Now, if you look at propaganda, it's a very interesting phenomenon. The major propaganda institutions are the public relations industry. The media are kind of part of it, but a small part. Where did the public relations industry develop? Well, it developed in the freest countries in the world, the United States and England. It did not develop in dictatorships and so on. And there's a good reason for that. I mean, as people win freedom, elite groups recognize they cannot control them by force anymore. So they're going to have to control their opinions and attitudes. And as more and more freedom has been won, privileged groups, you know, state-private power is usually an amalgam, figure out ways of trying, of other ways of controlling people. You can't do it by force. Do it by opinion and attitude. And you see this pretty dramatically. So if you go back to, say, Franco-Spain dictatorship, they published things very freely, you know, more freely than here. You know, those bookstores were selling Marxist literature, you know, overthrow the state, whatever you want. And they didn't care that much because the people walking around Madrid passed by the big torture chamber in the center of the city and they could hear people screaming. So, okay, you want to talk, talk. That's what will happen to you if you ever do anything. By the time you get rid of torture chambers in the center of this city, you know, and fear of security forces' violence, because you just won too much freedom, well, then you have to turn to more subtle techniques to control people, and that's where all this comes from. And it's pretty self-conscious. You know, you take a look at the advertising literature, they say it straight out. Mm-hmm. Same with elections. And if you really want a good picture of the period we're going through now, the best expression of it that I know remains a book that came out about 30 years ago in reaction to the 1960s. The 1960s scared the daylights out of everyone. There was just too much freedom, too much democracy. People weren't under control. And there was a book, an interesting book called The Crisis of Democracy, which wasn't from the right. It was coming out of the liberal internationalist sectors, Trilateral Commission. It's the people who were in Carter's cabinet, basically. Same ones in Europe and Japan. And they were talking about the crisis of democracy. The crisis is worth reading. The crisis is that there's too much democracy. The 60s were just getting people energized. You know, people who were supposed to be passive and apathetic, you know, like young people and women and the elderly and working people and everyone, they were suddenly pressing their demands. And that won't work. We need more what they call moderation in democracy, because they're kind of overwhelming the functions of the state. It's kind of like a hidden, unstated premise there, that the function of the state is to provide, is what Madison said, to protect the minority, the opulent against the majority. So nobody in the book says that corporations ought to stop lobbying. In fact, lobbying was going up through the sky at that point, because they have the right to control the state. The ones who don't have the right are what they call special interests, like the entire population. They're all special interests. So they have to be shut up and returned to apathy. And it's the same with schools. Like they said, the institutions responsible for the indoctrination of the young, it's their phrase, aren't doing their job. Young people are getting too free and independent and thinking for themselves and so on. So they have to do a better job of indoctrination. They even said the press was too free. Now, if you look back at the press, it's mind-boggling. They said if the press continues to be too adversarial, we'll have to have government controls on it. These are the liberals. Okay, right about that time, it's part of a wave of reaction to what was going on in the 60s and went on even more in the 70s and the 80s, because the big popular movements are not the 60s. I mean, the women's movement, for example, was the 70s. The environmental movement's the 70s, the anti-nuclear movement's the 80s, solidarity movement is the 80s, big global justice movements are the 90s. So you have to keep trying to beat it down because it just won't go back into its shell. And you get a whole lot of changes at that point. I mean, that's when the whole neoliberal business starts. If you take a look at the neoliberal economic principles, I mean, there's no economic motivation for them. In fact, they're harmful to the economy. But they are very anti-democratic. Every single element of the neoliberal package is an attack on democracy. And that's well understood. I mean, freeing up financial flows. Now, that wasn't done for reasons of economic efficiency. What it does is, and this is well understood, it takes away from governments the capacity to make decisions. And that's why Brazil today can elect, you know, kind of a left social democrat, and he can't do anything. He's got to follow the same reactionary policies because there'll be capital flight and attacks on the currency and so on. So thanks to Clinton and others, these countries are now in the stranglehold of international financial markets. That's the point of breaking down the financial controls that held in the 50s and 60s. Privatization is the same thing. And there's no economic motive for privatization, but just by definition, you know, takes things out of the public arena, puts them in the hands of private tyrannies. I mean, why does Bush want to, you know, the Bush guys want to destroy Social Security? Is it for economic reasons? Well, you know, partly. I mean, like Wall Street will get a bonanza. But that's not the main point. The main point is that it takes things out of the arena of public choice, public decision. And in fact, here there's a deeper reason. Social Security is based on an idea that you really have to beat out of people's heads. Like, I care about somebody else. See, Social Security is based on the idea that I'm supposed to care if a disabled widow across the street doesn't have enough food. And you got to drive that out of people's heads. A lot of education is devoted to that. It's to getting people to be purely individualistic. I'm out for myself. And, I mean, I hear that from students. You know, I mean, I didn't do anything to that disabled widow. Why should I take off from my $500,000 a year income to give her 5 cents? You know, I didn't. I'm not responsible for her. You know, if somebody didn't take care of her, it's her problem. In order to turn people into pathological monsters like that, it takes a lot of indoctrination, and getting rid of Social Security is part of it. It undercuts the conception that you care about each other. And it goes on at every level.
How well do you think the global peace movement is addressing private control of capital, and also maybe comment on the terminology, the language being used. Often activists are calling themselves part of the anti-globalization movement, coming from the globalization movement, which started off as being a good thing, people being part of one world.
Well, globalization comes from the left. I mean, that's why every union is called an international. I mean, the goal of the dream of the left and the working class movements from the 1900s were to have international solidarity. So that's globalization among people. But the way the term is used now, globalization means transferring control to narrow sectors of state-private power. That's what's called globalization. It's nothing to do with globalization. If you talk about, say, you know, any used neutrally, globalization just means various forms of international integration. Okay, well, you can have a particular form that's geared to the interests of investors and lenders and, you know, corporations and so on, and that's what's officially called globalization. And unfortunately, it's right to protest against that, but unfortunately, a lot of activists have accepted the propaganda and call themselves anti-globalization, which is a term that should never be used. I mean, in fact, sometimes it's comical. Like, you go down to Porto Alegre, where the World Social Forum is meeting, and there's people from all over the world, you know, every walk of life. I mean, you know, Indian women, you know, everything. And they're saying we're against globalization. Well, what are you doing? You know, what you're doing is the ultimate in globalization, but at the level of people. You're bringing people from all over and from every, you know, manner of life and so on, from every country, to work on their common problems. That's globalization, if you mean people. But they call themselves anti-globalization because globalization has been turned into a word that means international tyranny under the control of a narrow sector of tightly integrated multinational corporations tied to a couple of powerful states with their own institutions like the IMF and so on. So yeah, it's a crazy term. But the movements, global justice movements, are completely new. Never anything like them. And they're a totally new phenomenon. There's nothing like them in history. And they're part of the outgrowth of the solidarity movements that developed in the 80s, which were also new, the anti-war movements, which were new. And, you know, among popular groups, this is enormous. And it shows up in popular opinion. Like the attitudes I was mentioning of the public, they don't come out of nowhere. You know, they are reflections of the kind of activism that's been going on. Now, there's a constant battle about this. I mean, the general public is kind of disorganized, but they're fighting, they may not know it, but they're fighting a vicious class war against small groups which are highly organized and plan and have capital and have violence at their command, and they want to keep what they have and destroy any challenge to it, whether it's a military challenge or a popular challenge. They're very anti-democratic. They're strongly opposed to markets because people could make informed choices. They want control and domination, and they also run the propaganda system. But, you know, these are things we can see through. Like I said, it's not quantum physics.
In the 1940s, you were part of the Zionist movement that thought it was a mistake to establish a Jewish state. Many people equate statehood as a strategy for safety, for particularly for groups of people that have suffered greatly. How well has safety for Jewish people been achieved in Israel, and how will Palestinians be served if a Palestinian state is created?
Well, I was part of, as a Zionist activist, in fact, you know, youth leader and so on, but part of a group that was opposed to a Jewish state. And I said, and it's a bad idea. It was then, it is now. I mean, just as opposed to an Islamic state or a Christian state. Like, if the United States was a Christian state, I'd be opposed to it. Pakistan is an Islamic state, and I'm opposed to it. I mean, if these things are purely symbolic, you know, like you take off Sunday instead of Wednesday, okay, it's not a big deal. But when they go beyond symbolic, and they do, it is a big deal. And Israel is a Jewish state in ways which go way beyond symbolic. I think that's harmful for its Jewish citizens, and it's very harmful for its non-Jewish citizens. So I thought it was a mistake then. I think it's a mistake now. Once a state is established, it should have all the rights of any state in the international system, no more, no less. There's no legitimacy to that. I don't think any state is legitimate. But that's the order of things, and some state has the right to what everyone else has. It's just like if I don't happen to like the laws, I nevertheless think that everyone has the same rights under them. Okay, so Israel, once established, had the rights of any state, no more, no less. Israel and the United States alone demand that Israel have unique rights that no other state has. And that came about in the 1970s. By the 1970s, Israel was granted by its adversaries all the rights of any state in the international system. Yeah, I'll be done in a second. That means crucially the right to, the wording is the right to exist in peace and security within secure and recognized borders. Okay, that was finished. Well, you had to find some new way to prevent negotiations and diplomacy so as to maintain the expansionist programs that the U.S. and Israel were following. So they elevated it to a new right, the right to exist. And now people have to accept its abstract right to exist. Well, that's something that nobody will ever grant. I mean, it's telling Palestinians, you not only have to accept Israel, you have to accept the legitimacy of your expulsion. I mean, it would be like telling American Indians, you've got to accept the right of the United States to exist, like you've got to accept the legitimacy of your extermination. Mm-hmm. I mean, nobody's ever going to accept that, nor should they. Like, I don't accept the right of France to exist, or anybody. They don't have any right to exist. But that was raised, and that's now common propaganda, only as a barrier to diplomacy. And it had to do with the fact that the U.S. and Israel were blocking every possible diplomatic settlement from the 70s and still are. So what would a Palestinian state be? Probably rotten. But if that's what they want, they got a choice. If they make it a racist state, I'll be opposed to it. But it should have whatever states any other states have, and they should all be dissolved. This one too.
How far away are we from that experiment of dissolving states?
Moving towards it. So take, say, Europe. I mean, for hundreds of years, the highest value of Europeans was to slaughter each other. There was nothing more important than if you're French slaughtering Germans, if you're German slaughtering French. This went on for hundreds of years. Finally, in 1945, Europeans realized that the next time they play the game, it's over. The means of destruction have reached such lethal proportions, you just can't do it anymore. You can attack defenseless people, but you can't attack each other. So that settled into something that political scientists call the democratic peace. They say, well, that's because they're democracies. I don't think it's because it's democracies. It's because they know you just can't play the game anymore. It's finished. So Europe moved towards some kind of integration. And it's doing it in a complicated fashion, and part of it is the dissolution of the state structures. So take, say, Catalonia. Catalonia is one of the steps towards dissolving what people there call the Spanish state. Like, they don't say they're living in Spain. They say they're living in the Spanish state, but in an autonomous region of it. And same in the Basque region, same in Wales, same's happening elsewhere. There is a move towards a more reasonable form of human life. In which people have autonomy, whether it's community or ethnic or, some other mode of interaction, whatever it may be. They have their own languages, their own cultures. You go down to downtown Barcelona now on Sunday morning. I've been there, you have too. You see people streaming in to the cathedral in the center of town doing traditional folk dances, traditional music, and all this kind of stuff. Yeah, that's reviving an indigenous culture that had been suppressed. It was never destroyed, but it was suppressed. It's coming out. Well, okay, that's steps towards dissolution of a state system, but it's illegitimate.
I want to thank you very much for speaking with me. I appreciate it. I wonder if you could just give me a station. You've been listening to an interview with Noam Chomsky. Noam Chomsky is the author of about 70 books, many of them best-selling political works, including American Power, The New Mandarins, 9/11, and his most recent book, Hegemony or Survival, America's Quest for Global Dominance. Noam Chomsky is also widely credited with having revolutionized modern linguistics. This interview was recorded on November 19th, 2004, at MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts. My name is John Malkin. The name of this program is The Great Leap Forward. You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz. You can hear this program every Wednesday night from 7 to 9 p.m. This program is dedicated to exploring social change and spiritual growth, compassion, and anarchy. I'm very grateful to have had the opportunity to meet in person with Noam Chomsky, and very wonderful experience. And you are listening to your community-based, commercial-free radio station, Free Radio Santa Cruz. We are streaming on the World Wide Web at www.freakradio.org. The phone number here in the studio is 831-427-3772. Our P.O. Box for sending donations in any amount is P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Our voicemail number is 831-427-4523. Stay tuned right here to Free Radio Santa Cruz.